I'm Bae, and you're listening to Bae Baltimore, a weekly pop culture and society podcast recorded in a quiet neighborhood in Baltimore. This week, I watched Blonde on Netflix, and I have some thoughts. But first, I also watched Dahmer on Netflix, and I too have some thoughts. Although I will just come right out and tell you, I didn't finish it, not because the acting was not good. I do think that Evan Peters did a really good job as Dahmer, so much so that I can appreciate why now, if you recall a couple of years ago, before the pandemic, there were news reports coming out where Evan Peters had acknowledged that he needed some help coming out of the character of Dahmer, that he'd gone to a really low place to get that performance. And he needed some help. He needed some psychological help, or he needed a clinician to help him come back out of that. He didn't like who he had become in that moment, and he needed to be free following the cut or whatever, the final scenes of the show or the series, he needed some help to climb out of that hole that he had dug himself in to be Dahmer. And I can, having watched 5 of the 10 episodes, I can appreciate why he might have needed that help, because he, in portraying this murderer, goes to some pretty dark places. And I can appreciate how it would take some doing to get out of there psychologically. And, you know, I'm reminded even now how people say that Johnny Depp never really truly stopped playing Hunter S. Thompson from Fear and Loathing. Arguably there are people saying that what you see, there are aspects of what you see of Johnny Depp today that aren't him, but are as like a portrayal of, or mannerisms that he adopted from Hunter S. Thompson. And there are just a number of different actors that you can point to who so embodied the role that they were playing that it took a minute for them to get back to themselves. And so, you know, good, bad, or indifferent, I think it's a commitment. I think you got to admire the commitment to the role. But anyway, so Evan Peters' acting was good. I'm familiar with the story. I was a child when Dahmer was convicted. No, excuse me. I was a child when he was convicted. I was also a child when he was killed in prison. I remember hearing on the radio that he had been killed and that he had turned over a new leaf. He was a born again Christian, and, you know, at the point of his death, he was a changed man. And I remember thinking, 1994, as a child, I remember thinking, feels too easy. And I think over the years, especially as I was old enough to, on my own, learn exactly what put him in prison, I was able to, over the years, gather the language that I didn't have to articulate why in 94, when I learned of his passage, the way that people talked about him didn't really set right with me, that he had turned over, you know, he had changed his life. That felt too easy for me. What do you mean you changed your life? You stopped taking other people's lives? Because that's what you were in prison for. So not doing that is a change, but I don't know if it's one to be celebrated. And I think the thing that was so off-putting to me was that there was a little bit of not celebration, but there was some peace about his passing that some Talking Heads had that really frustrated me. When I say Talking Heads, I'm talking about radio personalities and TV personalities. He took a lot of people's lives. And I did not have the language when I was a child to articulate why that bothered me so much, the way that they talked about him. But now, being the big age that I'm at, that's why. It's not as if he was a thief and was stealing. I mean, he was a thief in a way. He did steal lives, several people's lives over the years. But it wasn't as if he were committing grand larceny or even embezzlement, that you can just stop embezzling and that'll be cool. And those, for the most part, are victimless crimes. I mean, within reason, if you drain somebody's savings account, there are victims of that. And people's lives are changed forever. But money can come back. You can get that money back. You know what you can't get back? Your loved one that was taken from you. You can't get them back. And so it just never really sat right with me. Some Christian, right-wing Christians, the way that they talked about Dahmer accepting Christ. Now, and I'm saying all of this and turning a new leaf over in his life. And I'm saying this as a person who's fully firm, standing firm in her own spiritual journey, recognizing that I'm still learning every day. Also recognizing that because I am a mere human, I have, in the Christian sense, no heaven to keep a person from and no hell to put them in. I am truly living out my spiritual practice on faith. The faith that what I'm doing, it has meaning, right? So I'm fully aware of that. But I cannot believe that it is as easy and as comparable as embezzling money, right? And just not doing it ever again. And so anyway, I guess that's not my cross to bear, but that was the memory that I remember. That was the memory that I had of Jeffrey Dahmer when I was a child, about the way some Christian people talked about he'd done this horrible thing, but boy, he was absolved and he's good to go. That's a little too easy for me. That was a little rough. And so looking back, there is a reason that I stopped watching the series. And again, it has nothing to do with Evan Peters. He did a good job. Even Niecy Nash is in there doing a good job. It is the reaction to the show that is turning my stomach that stopped me from watching. There are a number of people on social media, and before you suck your teeth at me and roll your eyes, I understand that social media is a wild place and it is a land of make-believe and you should not get wrapped up in it, but there's a whole lot of truth. You know, the best lies are built on truths or sandwiched between two truths. And so what we know is that people who've committed terrible crimes, people who've committed terrible crimes, if they are deemed in some capacity to be attractive, there are a number of people who can justify or make light of their actions. Look at Richard Ramirez. There are several documentaries and movies about him and his crimes on social media and definitely on Netflix. You remember how they caught Richard Ramirez? And actually, Richard Ramirez and Jeffrey Dahmer have a lot in common. Both of them were caught by citizens. Jeffrey Dahmer was caught because a relentless neighbor said, you're not going to keep doing this. You're not going to keep doing this. And kept making reports. And then what we know is that his intended final victim didn't actually, or escaped. His intended final victim escaped to tell the tale. Richard Ramirez, but before that, what we know is that the police returned one of his victims to him. And that Jeffrey Dahmer had been taking lives since he was a teenager. And there were opportunities for the police to stop him, and they didn't. And you could fill in the blank as to why. There are a number of different reasons why. I think the documentary, it posits a reason. It gives you a rationale for why. And none of them are good, by the way. None of the rationales for why the police didn't intervene sooner to save these lives, to save more lives, is, you know, there's no good answer for that. And there are a number of different ones that are floating out there. But anyway, so a concerned neighbor helped raise the A relentless, concerned neighbor kept raising suspicion, but it was only when the final intended victim broke free that Jeffrey Dahmer was captured and jailed. Richard Ramirez, who had victimized several people, was caught by concerned citizens. They were beating him senseless. And the police found him being beaten senseless and rescued him from the angry mob of concerned citizens who were beating him senseless. But in both of these situations, it wasn't the police that stopped these people who were doing monstrous things to other human beings. It was concerned citizens. And I think my only point there is, like, daggone it, how many lives could have been impacted if just the police were in a place to do good work, to actually stop crime. And so anyway, so you think about these, and why did I bring up Richard Ramirez? Richard Ramirez had groupies. That was one of the big things. I remember him being on trial. I don't remember understanding exactly what he was on trial for. I know he had hurt, again, here it is. I knew he hurt people. That was my language when I was a child, that he hurt people. I don't think I really truly grasped the concept of death until I was a teen. But when I was a preteen, I just knew that people hurt other people. And they did it a lot. And in this context, Richard Ramirez hurt a bunch of women. And even though he was in trouble, and he was certainly going to jail for the rest of his life, there were these women, and actually I think I might have been, I don't even know if I was old enough to have, I think I'm remembering archival footage of the trial. Richard Ramirez. Yeah, I wasn't old enough. I wasn't five. When he was being convicted. I wasn't even five yet, but I remember in the 90s, it must have been one of those things where, you know, when I was becoming aware and being able to at least process certain pieces of information that, you know, when I was aware of what was happening with Jeffrey Dahmer, that, you know, news outlets must have also been talking about Richard Ramirez, because Richard Ramirez didn't die until he was in 2013. He died in 2013, but he was convicted in the in 89. And anyway, you know how they do. They, when you're talking about one criminal who's done this one thing, you bring up other criminals who've done something similar. And anyway, I remember them bringing up Richard Ramirez and him having a fan club. I didn't know the term groupie back then. I knew them as fans. And I knew there were a bunch of women. But as I got older, I recognized that those were groupies. And so anyway, why am I talking about Richard Ramirez and groupies? It's because, again, I told you that the reason why I stopped watching, not Bundy, what's the old dude's name? Dahmer. Is because it was disturbing already, but what really disturbed me and turned my stomach was the way that some people were lusting after this man who was clearly not well and could only get, I don't even want to paint the picture, but he was not well. And there are people who are saying, I wish he would have taken me home. Honey, if he would have taken you home, he would have taken your life. Because the only way that he could find true pleasure is by ending your life. That's he laid it all bare to the detectives. And probably over the years before he was murdered, why he did what he did. And so to just lust after that is frustrating for me to no end. And it turned my stomach and it made it even creepier, the show. So I stopped watching it. The way that we disassociate sometimes is mind boggling to me. Do you know that there was a family, a brown family, I think they might've been Laotian or something like that. They were of Asian descent. Two brothers were impacted by Jeffrey Dahmer. One of them lived to tell the tale. The other one did not. And what about the neighbor lady? Jeffrey Dahmer's neighbor who knew Jeffrey Dahmer was up to no good. And then she was proven right. I don't know. I think I would spend the rest of my days trying to not think of moments where I heard a strange noise and considered whether or not that was the moment where he was taking somebody's life. That would haunt me. That would haunt my dreams. The man that escaped, his final victim, that would haunt my dreams. What he had to endure. That would haunt my dreams. But again, I understand people are going to be people. It's just, that was a bridge too far for me. I couldn't do it. I'm sure other people can disassociate with more freedom and ease and just be able to look at it for the program that it is. It's not me. I can't do it. And so anyway, I was going to review Dahmer, but it was just too disturbing. I think the only thing that it blows my mind is that I know that it's a drama, right? But I can't help but think how many people failed Dahmer along the way. How far science has come. How far medical advancements have come to understand. Like, you have to think about how far they've come to know that Jeffrey Dahmer probably could have gotten some help. It may not have changed the outcome, but maybe it could have. Also, it did not hurt if it is true that his father encouraged him. Well, no, because encouraging your children to do things is one thing. I don't think you can. I think it's clear that the family knew something was wrong with him. But they were They didn't know how to deal with him. I think that's a fair assessment. So to be the parents of Jeffrey Dahmer, to be the survivor, the surviving supposed final victim of Jeffrey Dahmer, to be the neighbors of Jeffrey Dahmer, that's a hard thing. And then to just to turn around and make light of it. Again, it's easy for people to make fun of stuff they don't know anything about or they feel like they have no connection to. It's a heck of a lot harder to make light or be cute about situations that you are familiar with and that they hit close to home. And so anyway, I couldn't in good conscience finish. I'm sure quite a number of other people have. I just didn't want to be in that number. Because I just didn't want to be a part of it. So I just didn't watch it. But I ended up watching Blonde on Netflix, which has a lot of controversy around it because of the telling of the story. And I got to admit, that is a hard story. Everybody is familiar, or most people are familiar with Marilyn Monroe's story, that her name was actually Norma Jean Baker, and that she created this persona to be rich and famous. And there are a lot of, and then she died tragically. Everyone knows that she died of a drug overdose. But what makes this movie controversial is how you get from point A to point B. How you get from Norma Jean, the child, to Marilyn Monroe, the adult. Let me rephrase that. How do you go from Norma Jean Baker, the vulnerable child? And there are certainly many instances where this movie, which is loose, it takes licenses. It takes some creative licenses. But nevertheless, there's a lot of truth in there. But it's embellished. And so this movie takes a young, vulnerable Norma Jean all the way, takes us from there to all the way to adult, drug-addled Marilyn Monroe, who died at age 36. The journey that you go on is interesting, to say the very least. It implies in some places and outright says in others that, you know, she was trying to find love, and in doing so, she kept running into the wrong men. And so it goes through that. There's a lot of hard scenes in this film as well, which I can appreciate why it would be difficult for some to watch. And so what I'll do in the next segment is I'll do what I typically do. I'll do the particulars on the show. I won't be able to give box office because it's a Netflix production. But I'll be able to talk about who's starring in it. The critical reception, which it's very interesting to say the very least. And I'll also just talk about some hot major themes, because this film too disturbed me. It was very disturbing. It was kind of hard to watch in moments. And what's her name? Ana de Alma. I'll just say this. She has an accent, and sometimes you can hear it. She tries very hard, and I won't knock her for it, but she tries very hard not to have an accent in this film. And Marilyn Monroe's voice, because it's not a real voice, or at least it's a voice that feels like a caricature. Many people have mimicked her voice. But there's only so many. The actress, you can clearly hear her you can clearly hear her natural accent coming through sometimes, and it's a little, it throws you off in some scenes, but you look past it to see the film itself. So anyway, so I'll talk about all of that in the next segment. And I will, I mean, spoil, well, I guess I will have spoilers, so I will put a spoiler alert in here, because I'm definitely going to be spoiling aspects of the film. Even though you know the story, you don't know how we get there. And so anyway, and the how we get there is the controversial part. And so anyway, in the next segment, it's all about Blonde. Okay, so Blonde was released September 16th. It was directed by Andrew Dominik, producers Brad Pitt, hey, Scott Andrew Robertson, Didi Gardner, Jeremy Kleiner, and Tracy Landon. It's cinematography by Chase Irving. Oh, it does have a budget. Its budget, well, but doesn't tell you the box office. So the budget was $22 million. I'm wondering if it made its money back. It stars Ana de Armas as Norma Jean. And who's her mama? Oh, Julian Nicholson is Gladys, Norma Jean's mama. What the heck? You guys, I didn't know something. No, this isn't right. This isn't right. Oh, this is in the theaters, P.S. This is in a few theaters in where I am. So I imagine this, it's in a few theaters where you are. But it is definitely a... well, September 16th. So that must be when it was released in the theaters. It was released in theaters September 16th. But it was released on Netflix the day before the release of this podcast episode. So anyway, Ana de Armas, Norma Jean, Julian Nicholson as Gladys, Norma Jean's mama. And then something else is weird is happening here, and I don't think I noticed it. So when we get to Marilyn Monroe, that's played by Jessica Chastain, which feels like not the truth. It doesn't feel like the truth. Because that looks like... I don't think this is the truth. Hold on, let me click on Jessica Chastain. Yeah, that's not the truth. Well, that's... See, this is why you don't... This is why you don't pay attention to doggone head Google. Google be messing you up, because Jessica Chastain probably played Marilyn Monroe. And that's another thing. Marilyn Monroe has been done a million gazillion times because there's a fascination with her. And there's a grossness to this film that reminds me of the male gaze and the public's obsession with her. But Jessica Chastain did not play. See, that's messed up. She did not play Marilyn Monroe in Blonde. That was totally Ana de Armas. Hold on, let me just do the personal career. Yeah, she didn't do it. And I don't know why that's up there. Anyway, where I was going with this was... Ana de Armas plays Norma Jean, and she also plays Marilyn Monroe, which is Marilyn Monroe's character. The loves of her life, which everybody should know at this point, the two main loves of her life were Joe DiMaggio, the baseball player, and Arthur Miller, the playwright. She was married as a teenager, but this movie does not talk about that. So I'll just talk about the two stars that play DiMaggio and Miller. So Bobby Cannavale plays Joe DiMaggio, and I swore he was Latinx. I swore he was Latinx, but he doesn't claim Latinx heritage.
Latinx, Hispanic heritage, although maybe I've just been watching too many TV shows where he played a TV Latinx person, which I didn't think was a real thing these days, but apparently it is. Anyway, so Bobby Cannavale plays Joe DiMaggio, a much more handsome Joe DiMaggio, because if you look at the pictures, baby, he was not fine. But anyway, Bobby Cannavale is handsome. Anyway, and then Adrian Brody plays Arthur Miller, which again is a more attractive version of Arthur Miller, because if you look at Arthur Miller, you do wonder why Marilyn Monroe was with these two folks, but then you probably recognize that she was not with them for their looks, which is really mean to say, but it is what it is. All right, so then you have, who else do I want to mention? There is a salacious moment in the movie where the movie suggests that Norma Jean was in a relationship, a throuple, with what's the man's name? Houdini, the guy that played Houdini. I forget Houdini's real name. No, Charlie Chaplin. She was in a relationship with Charlie Chaplin Jr. and Edward G. Robinson Jr. Edward G. Robinson and Charlie Chaplin were some dynamo stars back in the day. Back in the 20s, the 30s and 40s. And in the 50s, it was this movie alleges that Norma Jean was in a throuple with both of their sons, who are their namesakes. So again, Edward G. Robinson Jr. and Charlie Chaplin Jr. And that her true love was really Charlie Chaplin Jr. Anyway, one of the people that plays Charlie Chaplin Jr. was named, she called Cass, and the actor was Xavier Samuel. I won't be talking about the actor anymore. I'll be talking about the characters that are played, and I want to make sure I'm not missing anything. Here's another thing to note. There is a man that has very little speaking parts throughout the film, but his face is seen throughout the film from the time that we see the vulnerable Norma Jean, who's a child who needs protection, all the way up to the 36-year-old drug addict. The 36-year-old drug addict, Marilyn Monroe, who also needs some support and needs some support. Anyway, and this person is her father. He's never named. There's a whole scene in the very beginning where the mother goes out of her way to say, I can never name him. He's a big time studio exec, but here's his picture, but you can never show it to anybody. And what a way to traumatize your child, especially in a time frame where it is taboo to be in a broken home. It is taboo for your parents not to be married. And anyway, so she never knows her father's name. She's just left guessing throughout the whole film. And again, this film is an exaggeration on things that were true in her life. And one of the things that was true in her life is that she did not have a relationship or much of a relationship with her father. And it's alleged that she really didn't know who her father was. And anyway, this actor, Tig Runyon, however you say it's T-Y-G-H, however you say that. Ty Runyon is this mysterious figure that is playing her father, that you always see him in a fedora, a trench coat and tie with a mustache and a little goatee under his lip. You mostly just see him in side profile from the beginning of the film all the way to the end, the sad, sad end. But anyway, so I'm going to just, though, focus on Norma Jean. Okay, so this movie, oh, well, hold on, before I get there, let me just tell you about the critical reception, if we're honest. The critical reception is as follows, which is, it's not the greatest in the whole wide world. I just need you to
it's actually kind of all over the place. So it's six out of 10 on IMDb. And you know how I feel about IMDb. It's 49%. So that's rotten on Rotten Tomatoes. The consensus is Blonde can be hard to watch as it teeters between commenting on exploitation and confronting it. But Ana de Armas's luminous performance makes it difficult to look away. So on the tomato meter, it's 49%. That's out of 179 reviews from critics. The audience score is 41%, so it's worse, and that's 500 plus ratings. And I have a feeling I know why this is. I would not say that this movie is a 50% movie. I would say that it's a 60% movie. And the reason why I would say that is for one of the reasons why I already mentioned Ana de Armas, who, what is this actress? Where is her? Cuban Spanish. So one of her parents is Cuban and one of her parents is from Spain. And she was born in Santa Cruz. Del Norte. Santa Cruz in the north. And Cuba. Anyway. Norte. De Norte. I wonder if Norte means north. Anyway. She's got an accent. And I guess I didn't recognize it to be a Cuban accent. But she definitely has an accent as an actress. Anything that you've watched her in, she has an accent. It's not a strong one, but it's definitely there. You can hear it. And so again, she slips. She slips a couple of times when she's playing Marilyn Monroe. Even when she puts on that affect that everybody adopts, which can be pretty annoying because you recognize... I always recognized anything that I saw, like any movies that she played in or any interviews that she did, that read to me as an affect. The way that Ana de Armas played her, that was Norma Jean. And so I just don't know that anybody buys that that was actually Norma Jean, especially since in a time in Hollywood where literally they were whitewashing stars like for realsies. There's a particular star, and I have a point to this. There's a particular star, it's not Jean Harlow. Rita Hayworth. Rita Hayworth, I believe Rita Hayworth is actually Latinx. Her people, both are on her, well, I don't know if only one of her parents is from Mexico or not, or in a Latinx country or not. But she definitely, if you see the before photos, before Hollywood got to her, she looks very, very Latina, Latinx, completely. And it's her hair, her eyebrows, the way she styled herself, she dressed culturally. And so within reason, she was trying to dress as pretty as the prettiest woman in her community would, which still had showed her ethnicity. And so what they did was, I think, what was her maiden name? Hold on, it's important. Rita Hayworth. Man, when I tell you, they changed. They said she's an American actress. Her full name was Margarita Carmen Cancino. Margarita Carmen Cancino. If you look at this woman's hairline, her hairline changed by the time that Hollywood got her. So she went from, she was from New York. So she probably sounded like a Boricua. Maybe an early Boricua. I don't know when that culture kind of congealed, but I'm guessing it was probably around the time that she was growing up and living there. But there are old photos. Some TikToker put me onto this, but they showed pictures of how they had Hollywood had whitewashed Rita Hayworth. First off, they named her Rita instead of Carmenita. They literally surgically changed her hairline so that her hair wouldn't grow back
as thick and as forward. And I think they did this by a process of like, there was some sort of chemical that they put in her temple, which probably could not have been good. And if you tried to do it today, it would probably like do some damage for realsies. Anyway, but she is an example of a person that they whitewashed, who's clearly of Latinx descent, Latinx Hispanic descent. But they made her change everything about her, including her speaking. And so her speaking and her and the way she carried herself, turned her hair blonde, probably didn't allow her to sunbathe as much so that she could keep her skin light, and lightened her makeup too to make her pass as white. And anyway, so if they did that to her, you mean to tell me they would not have changed Norma Jean's way of being and speaking so that she could be more appealing to the male gaze? I think so. I think so. And the fact that I didn't get that change is frustrating to me. The fact that Norma Jean, let me just go ahead and say it. The fact that the little girl that played Norma Jean as a little girl looked like a little white girl, and Ana de Armas does not look like a little white girl. She looks like she's got Cuban blood running through her. She looks like she's got brown blood running through her, but the little child looks like she does not, that played her. And so I think it was strange, but that's what Hollywood does. That's what people tend to do. You know what I mean? Like an actor can play whomever, but like, let us not dispel. There was a moment there where you could at least have the child look a little bit more like Ana de Armas. They went out of their way to make Ana look real bright too in this film, which I think is interesting to say the very least. How is she lighter than these absolutely white actors is beside me. I could see how she would be lighter in tone than Cannavale, the guy that played Joe DiMaggio, but like the other actors, feels weird. Unless they intentionally lit her. They probably did intentionally light her to be lighter because they probably had Marilyn Monroe brighten her skin too. Brightening cream was a thing. Skin lightening was a thing in Hollywood since forever. And so maybe they did that on purpose. Anyway, I just found it odd. I just found it a little bit odd because the real actress is brown. She looks brown. Like, she's a light brown, but nevertheless, she's brown. Anyway, so, okay, now that I've said that, Ana de Armas's actual accent breaks through too many times for me to not notice. And then also the fact that she continues the affect even when she's not playing Marilyn Monroe. When she's just Norma Jean, she still keeps the affect, so that bothered me. The other thing that bothered me was the sheer... Ana de Armas' performance was hard to look away from, but it was also hard to stay in because it turned my stomach, which is not a bad thing in this instance, except she kind of... The movie made it seem like she was fragile, her whole life fragile, and that the people in her way to protect her did not protect her. Instead, they shielded her from other people's abuse so that she could be available for theirs. And the way that she played this woman whose circumstance was that, I don't know if her playing it that way disturbed me or the fact that that was probably a large part of her reality, the real woman, the real Norma Jean's reality. I don't know what's just, I don't know. I still haven't formed my thoughts on that, but it was disturbing all the same. I don't think she did a bad job. I just don't know if, I don't know if I liked portraying Marilyn Monroe that way. But again, What we know is that in Hollywood, here's what we know. Not only did Hollywood make actors change who they were completely to keep up this charade of their image and who Hollywood wanted the world to adore, which often meant you hid your sexuality, you hid who you were at your core, your heritage, your sex. Yeah, you hid all the things that made you you, your sexuality, your heritage. You hid all of that. You whitewashed yourself and you straightened, you butched yourself up, or you femmed yourself way up. So we know that that happened. So there's a piece of me that thinks this is how she should have played it, because this is a woman that had mommy issues and daddy issues from a child. Now, mind you, the film is an extreme version of that. But what we know is that actresses were taken advantage of, actors were taken advantage of from the very beginning. The carrot of fame and success was dangled in front of them. And at that time, and as is in many cases probably still true today, people would do just about anything to obtain that, including deny themselves, deny aspects of themselves. And so there are moments in this film where the film defines Marilyn Monroe's quest for fame and fortune as little to do with fame and fortune and everything to do with acceptance and finally being loved and claimed by her father. And they put a point on this notion at every turn. They remind you of this fact at every turn. Every time she's in front of the camera, she's looking awkward, but beautiful, and she knows how to pose, but she's looking awkward. Every time she's in the presence of an adoring man in her life, she's looking and behaving awkwardly, but because the other person is so enamored with her that she just, everybody gets what they want out of the situation, even if in the situation, Marilyn, played by Norma Jean, is probably leaving the situation confused. I'll give you an example. She wants to be a series actor. So Norma Jean walks into a film studio, an exec's office. And she goes in and it's clear that she's studied for this part. And she's reading it and she's dressed in all white. By the way, they keep her in white. They keep Marilyn Monroe, Norma Jean as Marilyn Monroe. They keep her in white in significant moments. Every significant moment in her life, she's dressed in white. And I don't know if that is intentional to signify her purity or not. I'm not sure if they're that on the nose, but maybe they are. But she's in white in every significant scene. And so she walks into the studio exec's office, and she does she reads for the part that she really wants. And following her reading, the studio exec, who looks to be in a robe, stands up, snatches the script from her, pushes her down and bends her over, and then pulls her underwear down. You know what's about to happen. And in that moment, the director spares us from seeing everything that's happening, but we are zoomed in on her face. And we see the blankness in her face. And we see the tears, like the muted cries. She's not even crying. She's just vacant. She's not there. While he is having his way with her, this exec. We see more emotion in this exec than we see in her. Following that interaction, she stands up, she gets herself together, and then she leaves the room asking if she got the part, but he never really responds to her. And then we see in the next scene, she actually does have the part.
And so this is the beginning. This is how we are to assume that Marilyn got her start. I don't know if, again, this is an embellished thought, but it actually doesn't seem super far-fetched when you consider that there are whole shows on Netflix and other streaming services that are dedicated to the brothels that were the Hollywood brothels that were all the rage in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and probably before that. We know that stars were given people as often as they wanted them for their own sexual pleasure behind closed doors. And so it's not too far-fetched of a theory that Norma Jean's entree into the movie business was sexual assault. It's just jarring to see. And again, she's in white and it turns your stomach what's happening, but she moves on. And we also know in this modern eye that we're looking at this film is that while psychology was something that was accessible, it was still something new in terms of its acceptance. It really wasn't accepted. If you went to a psychologist, if you saw a clinician, for anything other than a physical ailment, something that was deemed a physical ailment, you were looked at as a pariah, you were looked at as crazy, and you were threatened with being committed. And one of the very first scenes when we meet Norma Jean's mother, Gladys, what we know based on the film, now we know that she was able to engage with Gladys in her adult life more than the film shows. But the film wants us to believe that Gladys did not want Norma Jean and abused her as often as she could. And in one moment during the Hollywood Hills fires, she allowed her daughter to go live with someone else, and then she was committed. And so we are to believe that Norma Jean has been broken since she was a child at the hands of her mother, the one person that was supposed to protect her. She was left broken by her. And so what we miss in this film is we literally jump from her being a child all the way to her mother being committed and seemingly being committed for years. And now she's an adult, on up and coming star. What we miss is that she was married when she was 16. And that marriage didn't work out. And instead she moved on and became a Hollywood starlet, and it rose to fame. And then her first public relationship was with Joe DiMaggio. And from all of the films about, from all of the films about Marilyn Monroe and all of the documentaries that exist, what we know is that the Joe DiMaggio Marilyn Monroe connection was meant to stabilize her. Joe DiMaggio, a retired baseball player at the time, wanted one of the most beautiful women, one of the women that was considered to be one of the most beautiful women in the world, at his side, and she wanted stability. That's what the movie. The movie makes us think that Joe DiMaggio really wanted her because he was enamored with her and that she settled for Joe. What other movies and documentaries have suggested was that she really did genuinely love Joe DiMaggio, but he was a stabilizing force in her life. Before we get to Joe DiMaggio, though, what we see is, and this is heartbreaking, we see, again, we don't see that Marilyn Monroe was married at the age of 16 by her high school sweetheart. We see her in the film engaged in a throuple with Edward G. Robinson Jr. and Charlie Chapman Jr. And that she was really in love with Charlie Chapman, which, again, is debatable. It's at what they're saying in the reports is that there was a time where she was in a relationship with one or the other, but not in a throuple at any point. But this movie suggests, again, because it's, I guess, wants to be shocking, that there was a throuple situation and that they met in an acting class. I don't know how they met, and I don't think it matters. I don't think it's relevant how they met, but that they did meet. And it stands to reason that the sons of Hollywood stars, Hollywood titans, would come into the spotlight of Norma Jean as Marilyn Monroe. Because she's an up-and-coming starlet, and they in the movie, they're proposed to be this around the same age. They probably were around the same age. But anyway, she engages in a throuple with them, and the movie suggests that she becomes pregnant, but she chooses to terminate the pregnancy. And it's very heartbreaking, very emotional in that moment. And then the relationship... Here's something else that happens. The relationship, we kind of don't see the end of the relationship. We just recognize that the relationship has ended as Marilyn Monroe's career has expanded. And then we see her being courted by Joe DiMaggio for some months, maybe a year or two. And then we see she is still seeking her father everywhere she goes. And there's a moment after the airing of her first big break. I cannot remember her first big break, but if you look at her discography, one of her first big Hollywood break movies, that night of that premiere, the movie tells us that she gets a note from one of her staffers saying, make sure that you're alone when you go to your hotel. And in the movie, Norma Jean as Marilyn gets excited because she thinks it's my dad. Finally, it's my dad, because up until this point, her father, she's begun as an adult and with the throuple with Edward G. and Charlie Jr. Edward G. Robinson Jr. and Charlie Jr. She's been receiving these letters from her father periodically. And it gives you the sense of a deadbeat who just wants to string a child along. And so her enthusiasm for her father and potentially seeing her father is heightened at this point. And when she gets this note from her staffer saying, oh, make sure you're alone when you go to your hotel, she thinks her father's in the hotel, according to the movie. When she gets to the hotel room, it's a man sitting in the corner waiting for her arrival, but it's actually Joe DiMaggio. And in this moment, he proposes marriage, and her answer is yes, I guess, through tears. And then she begins to cry. And in this moment, it's another jarring moment. And again, this is a controversial, okay, as I'm talking about it, I think I don't love this portrayal of Marilyn, because while I think she was let down by everybody in her, many people in her life who were meant to protect her and help her to gain her own independence, I don't think she was this fragile, where at the proposal of a man that she had been dating for over a year, she begins to cry, not out of excitement or enjoyment or just overwhelming love for this man, but at disappointment that this man is not her father. They're married. She begins to call him daddy. It's gross. I think it's meant to be gross, though. Because again, she runs up to the room the night of her proposal, her engagement, thinking that it's her father in her hotel room. And then she proceeds to call this man, this older man, in Joe DiMaggio. In this film, the director and Anna decide that it's important that Norma Jean as Marilyn Monroe begins to call Joe DiMaggio daddy. And it's gross. And so throughout their time together, she calls him daddy. And she seeks his approval, and it's gross. Because literally, it's like a child seeking approval from her father. Only this is it kind of reminding you, it's putting you in the mind of something incestuous. And it's gross. I don't think you're supposed to be comfortable watching this, though. I think they want you uncomfortable. And I think that's part of the reason why critics have not given this a favorable review, and audience goers have given it an even less favorable review, because they're sullying this image of this woman that has been deemed as a sex symbol. The reality of it is, this was a pretty woman who was abused, maybe not as extremely as it was portrayed in film, but this is a pretty woman who was abused in the way that pretty women were in Hollywood back in the day, and not even in Hollywood, just in general. The rights of women were little to none. Arguing over crumbs, you know what I mean? And so in this relationship with Joe DiMaggio, what several movies and documentaries have confirmed was that Joe DiMaggio was jealous. They stop short of accusing him of abuse. But what we know is, in the 40s and 50s, spousal abuse was not a thing that was a big deal, that was frowned upon. At least in American culture, probably globally, but definitely in American culture, it wasn't a thing that was super frowned upon. We know that women's rights and protections against abuse for intimate partner violence didn't really become a thing until the late 80s, early 90s, and so on and so forth, right? And now it's intimate partner violence is the phrase, because we recognize that anyone can be a victim of violence in a intimate relationship. It doesn't have to be violence against women, although violence against women is pretty prevalent. Or when people who identify as women is pretty prevalent. Anyway, so this movie alleges that Joe DiMaggio, in his jealousy, was physically abusive to Norma Jean. And there's one particularly disturbing scene where Eddie G. Jr. and Charlie Jr. are essentially bribing Joe DiMaggio with pictures that they took with Norma Jean when they were a throuple. And of course, she's nude or half nude in most of the photos. And they present this to Joe DiMaggio. Joe DiMaggio is, you know, obviously angry, and rightfully so, angry with them for blackmailing her. But then he takes his aggression out on Maryland. And in this scene, he strikes her, he finds her, he runs through the house, doesn't even shut the door, runs through the house, finds her, strikes her. She's topless too, for some odd reason. But I don't think that's, she's at home. And she's at home and doing whatever. Maybe the movie wants us to suggest that Marilyn wanted to do things to please Joe. And so one of the ways to do that was to be topless, or maybe, I don't know, it was a choice. It was a choice. And maybe that was another reason why people panned this film. But she was naked a lot. Norma Jean was naked a whole bunch in this film. And it did feel in parts like it was excessive. But again, she was at home. She could be topless if she wanted to. She could sleep naked if she wanted to, which in this film, they suggest that Norma Jean did often, that she was naked most of the time. Anyway, so Joe DiMaggio comes home, he's livid, and as he's trying to find her, he's climbing the steps and you can see his rage growing. And then we find her in a bedroom, and he walks in and she greets him as, "Hey, daddy." And again, it's really gross. And she's topless, and he strikes her. And she immediately says, "Sorry." She apologizes and she said, "That's my fault. I guess I should have cleaned my room." So she thinks that the reason why he strikes her is because her bedroom is not clean. Again, it's very childlike. I don't suggest that Marilyn Monroe, as played by Norma Jean was as childish and childlike and damaged as they're making her seem, but I think they're exaggerating to prove a point. This woman needed protection, even in this moment. And I imagine they could have gone a different way, but even in this moment when Joe should have been protecting his wife, he brutalized her in this moment. And then there were other moments where he brutalized her when he felt like she was not being the proper wife. The scene, I think it's in Some Like It Hot, where she stands over the subway vent, and again, a very male gazy thing to do, but that was not her idea. That was the movie production's idea, was for her to stand over that vent and keep her dress from coming up at the front in that iconic scene that everybody has been done over and is in every 50s inspired restaurant across the United States and probably globally. But her in that white dress, again, she's in white. In that pose, that iconic pose. And I remember there was one film where they had Joe DiMaggio making her put on so many different pairs of underwear so that her pubic hair couldn't be seen. And again, I don't doubt that Joe DiMaggio was probably pretty jealous because their marriage was pretty short-lived. And as many times as people have made the reference to that, him being on set, he insisted that he was on set when she was filming certain scenes, especially romantic scenes with folks. And he was on set that day that it happened. And the idea is that day broke their marriage completely. That day broke his attachment to Marilyn Monroe. And that's when they split, basically. His jealousy just peaked in that moment, and she just wanted to be free. So they break up. She gets another divorce. So this is her second marriage now. And she's in New York. She's always wanted to be New York. She grew up in Los Angeles. She died in Los Angeles. But she makes it to New York, and she's striking out on her own. And this film suggests that she has always secretly been a film buff and really into acting in a meaningful way, and wanted to go to the premier acting studios to hone her craft. And there are certainly pictures of her coming out of the world famed actor studio in New York. Remember where, what was it, Ron Lipton? I can't remember his name, but the guy that used to host the Actors Guild, the guy that passed away a couple of years ago. He did the actor studio and would always interview these actors and basically show them this is your life, but for acting. And anyway, so that's a world famed acting studio that is associated with NYU, I think. And anyway, so there are real life pictures of her coming out of going into the actor studio. So we know that she was serious about her craft and that she spent some time in some pretty serious acting studios. And this is where, in this scene, in this act of this movie, which is, by the way, the runtime on this thing, I think is like 2 hours and 30 minutes. What's the runtime? 2 hours and 46 minutes. Because they just want to get it out. And anyway, so in this portion of the scene, we're at an hour at this point. Norma Jean is in an actor's studio. She has a really vulnerable moment and she connects with Arthur Miller. They connect in a meaningful way. They're married. She continues to do plays. She gets a house. They set up house. They're in this whirlwind romance, which again, by the time she meets Arthur Miller, she's probably in her late 20s, and Arthur Miller is well into his late 40s, early 50s. And I just don't know how anybody in their 20s could have a whirlwind romance with somebody in their late 40s, early 50s, but whatever. Anyway, so she's playing house. And one of the things that a lot of documentaries suggest, and certainly this film suggests as well, is that Arthur Miller's friends did not think that she was good enough for Arthur Miller. They thought she was just a pretty woman, but that she was dumb. And there's a moment where she she acknowledges this, and Arthur tries to dissuade her from that, thinking, no, they love you. But she's like, no, I don't think they do, but I will do this to you. And she also calls him daddy. She begins to, in their relationship, call him daddy. And there's a moment where you feel like this older man, who's intelligent, who doesn't want to control her, recognizes there's something wrong here. But he doesn't quite know how to address it, which is probably pretty indicative of the time. Because again, even among intellectuals, going to see a psychiatrist, getting medication for any kind of mental health conditions was seen still probably as a weakness. And so a woman who clearly had daddy issues, that he certainly knew of them at this point, who at this time was still getting letters from her dad who would just never present himself, is called daddy. And there's a couple of moments where Adrian Brody's Arthur Miller feels like he's uncomfortable at her calling him daddy, but doesn't say anything. And so their relationship does not, it's a relationship, and she becomes pregnant again. And she loses the child in the most sad way. She trips and falls. The movie suggests that she trips and falls and loses the pregnancy because of the trip and fall. And she's heartbroken. And the marriage to Arthur Miller doesn't last super long, maybe a couple of years, 3 or 4 years. And then it ends in bitterness and hatred. And she's begun to take, following the death of her second child now, or their second, early termination of her second pregnancy, she begins to be inconsolable, and the movie describes her as going through these fits of rage. And to calm her down, especially having these fits of rage on set, they dope her up. And so she's doped up, and then this is the beginning of her addiction to barbiturates. And she becomes a drunkard, and the relationship with Arthur Miller deteriorates. And you can't assume that it's just all her. It's probably the both of them, because again, the movie kind of alludes to the fact that he's not as caring as he should be, not as attentive as he should be as a husband. Also, there's a moment where he betrays Norma Jean in that he told her, I would never put you in any of my plays or my films. And then she finds some of his work where he has put her in there, and literally verbatim has written out a scene that they had together, like a real life situation that they had together. He's written it in a play, and she's hurt by that. And that begins the disconnection between the two of them. And of course, again, just like with Joe DiMaggio, we never see the split happen, but we know they're divorced. We know they end up divorcing. And then she's a free woman. She's in her 30s now. She's a Hollywood darling. She's a diva now. And she's got an alcohol and drug problem, and it's spiraling. But this is the moment where she begins to engage in a relationship with President Kennedy. And I have read things before, or watched documentaries before, that said her drug and alcohol abuse heightened when she was with President Kennedy because of the secret nature of their relationship. She was in love with him, and maybe she believed that he was in love with her, but that she was a secret and she hated it. And she couldn't do anything about the nature of their relationship, so she turned to drugs and alcohol. And this is what, in theory, there's a theory that suggested that this is the thing that turned her into an addict, a full-blown addict. And there is a very jarring scene with her and the president, the actor that played the president, where she is performing a sexual act on him. And what's the guy's name? He is literally on the phone as a president. Oh, Casper Philipson plays Kennedy. And he is literally laying in bed. She's been flown in. She's not staying the night, but she's been flown in to see him into DC from California, flown in to see him. And he's laid up in bed, half naked, on the phone, talking about being scolded by one of his staffers about keeping these women quiet and being a little neater with his cheating on Jackie. And while he's on the phone, the movie wants us to believe that while he's on the phone having this conversation and being chastised by one of his close confidants, Marilyn Monroe is performing. It directs Marilyn Monroe to perform a sexual act on him. And she does it to completion while he's still on the phone, while the other guy is listening, still chastising him for seeing other women, while his bedroom door is open and there's a Secret Service agent outside of it who can at any moment look in but can certainly hear what's happening. And then after she pleasures him, he begins to do whatever he wants to her. And then we see the aftermath of that, her being completely drunk. She's in white again. She's in white when she sees, well, she's in black and white when she sees Arthur Miller, but she's in white most of the time. When she's with Arthur Miller, again, she's white in most of the important scenes with Joe DiMaggio. She's also in white in most of the important scenes with Mr. President, only in this instant, following her tryst with him, her white is sullied now. Her makeup is smeared, her red lipstick is smeared, and half of it is on her dress. Her hair is white, so it's a symbol of purity or whatever, but her purity has been sullied by these men, consistently by these men. And in this moment, a man who is the most powerful people in the United States has done whatever he wanted to do with her in the presence of whomever, because he didn't care. And she's not better for it. And she gets sick, and it's very undignified the way that she leaves. She's dragged into his presence and she's dragged away from his presence. And it's after this that she goes back home to her bungalow in California, and she's just trying to be her own self. And for a third time, we learn that Norma Jean is pregnant, but of course she can't have the president's baby. And so she's tailed by Secret Service agents who whisk her away in the middle of the night, drug her up, take her baby, or in the pregnancy, and then drop her back off again. And she says it. She wakes up to saying, "It's just a dream. It's just a dream." She's naked in the bed. She gets out of the bed. She's like, "Oh, it's just a dream." What we see, but what she hasn't realized, is that her bottom half is completely bloody. So we know that it wasn't a dream. In this film, in this scenario, she's still believing it's a dream. She's high out of her mind. But what we know is that it wasn't a dream. This really did happen. They flew her out to end the pregnancy with the president's baby, and then drop her back off. And they didn't even bother to clean her up, suture her wounds from the surgery. She is just left to bleed, and she does so in her own bed. And now this is one more man who's done her wrong in her life. And now it's just her and her dog in her Hollywood bungalow. And the final straw is Eddie G calls her to let her know that Charlie Chapman Jr. has died, and he's left her something, and he's going to send her a package. She's heartbroken because, again, the movie wants us to believe that she was truly in love with Charlie Chapman Jr. and that Eddie G. Robinson Jr. was just a fling, but not really the love of her life that Charlie Jr. was. And so Charlie Jr. has now died of alcohol, vomit, poisoning, whatever. And he sent her this gift that she really needed. He wanted her to have. She begrudgingly accepts it. The Eddie G. Jr. sends it over to her, has it delivered to her. She opens the box. It's a tiger that she's been talking about, that she's had since she was a child, or that she was fond of since she was a child. And then in the box is a letter, a card. In that card, it's directed to her, and it's from Charlie Chapman Jr. And in it, he confesses that she was her father. Not actually, but the letter writer. And so these letters that her father, she's been receiving from her father for all of these years have actually been come from, were penned by Charlie Chapman Jr. And so two things happen at once. So she loses the love of her life, or the true love of her life, that she just is by studio exec told not to be with anymore. And actually, she probably couldn't have been with him. Not really. He probably didn't have the emotional capacity to be with her, according to this film. But that also, she's never heard from her father. It's been a lie this whole time. It was Charlie Jr. And so this movie supposes that at 36, she's spiraling out of control. And the last moments of the film are her literally spiraling out of control, crashing her, getting drunk and high, and crashing her car into a tree, then going home, reading this letter, getting this package, reading this letter, then spiraling again, not knowing who her father is, taking a bunch of barbiturates on purpose, calling someone, reaching out, clutching to call someone, but then slips into a coma and passes away in the night. And the ending scene is of her foot as the sun is creeping across her bedroom and her dog sitting at the door of her bedroom, waiting for her to move, but it never happens. What we know in real life is that she really did take too many pills, and it was deemed on purpose because she had way more than the lethal limit in a person. So it wasn't for pleasure, it was for escape. And she really did, according to lore, she really did die clutching a telephone as if she was reaching out to call someone. She did die in her home. And it's a sad ending. A lot of Hollywood starlets died that way. Similarly, I'm reminded of Dorothy Dandridge, who it was purported that she died of a drug overdose, but it was accidental. There were a lot of sad endings to Hollywood women who were used up by the men around her. Dorothy Dandridge's story is equally as painful. We don't have a whole lot of stories about Dorothy Dandridge because not many people know who Dorothy Dandridge is, except outside of the Black community. Not too many people know who Dorothy Dandridge is, but everybody knows Marilyn Monroe. And so I can understand why this portrayal of this story did not get a lot of accolades, and that a lot of people panned it, because this is a wild way to share this. I also think the nudity was a bit much and probably a lot for folks to take. I think the affect that Ana de Armas put on was maybe a bit much in parts, especially when she was playing Norma Jean. I also think her accent peeking through too many times was a detractor as well. I still think it's a thought-provoking movie, though, that is worth watching. And so if you do have the time, you should watch it. Even though I've spoiled the whole thing, you should still watch it. But anyway, I digress. I appreciate you for listening to today's episode. Look up Dorothy Dandridge and actually look up Marilyn Monroe to learn more about her life. Again, this movie was an exaggeration. Her ending is not so exaggerated, and there are other women in Hollywood who had bright, shining stars but were used up by Hollywood who you need to know, like Dorothy Dandridge. So I would invite you to use this time to get to know the both of them a little bit better in their own words. Anyway, but thank you so much for listening today. Thank you for rating and reviewing this podcast, 4 or 5 stars, whatever makes the most sense, and leaving favorable reviews. I will read them. And if you don't want to do either of those things, but you want to share this episode with anybody that you think might dig it, do that, because that will ultimately help me expand the reach of the show and get it into more podcast decks, I guess. So I would appreciate that immensely. Thank you so much for doing any of those things. Thank you. Thank you for listening, sharing, rating, and reviewing. All right, that's it. Take care of yourself today. Continue to take care of yourself as we move into the fall. Take your boosters, take your vitamin C, take good care of yourself, get good rest, drink plenty of water. All right. Until next time. Bye-bye.